On this afternoon's calendar, we have two related cases on calendar, both styled Popowitz versus District Court or Popowitz versus Shapiro. Their case numbers 58305 and 59806. My understanding is that the clerk has confirmed with counsel that we'll allot 30 minutes per side, and you may argue the two appeals together. Is that acceptable to both sides?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Is counsel ready to proceed? Please do.
Please, the court. I'm Al Marquis of Marquis Al Mark Coffin. We represent the petitioners on the writ, the appellants, the plaintiffs below. And I would like to reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal, please. And I apologize for this bandage on my face. My dermatologist thought a portion of my nose should be excised, and it's now on the mend. The mold in the story is sunscreen, I guess. We've got a petition in this appeal challenging certain rulings of the trial court in this action for prejudging our alter ego claim by dismissing it before any discovery could be conducted, and doing so with prejudice and without leave to amend, by sanctioning my clients, 86-year-old Ethel Popowitz, who was here, her daughter, who's in today, could not be here, and our firm, $5,000 for having made that alter ego claim. Then after discovery, after we discovered numerous facts to support the alter ego claim, by once again prejudging that claim and threatening to sanction us if we even attempted to amend our complaint to bring that forward, and then prejudging other claims in our motion to amend that were supported by facts revealed during discovery, denying that motion in total, simply saying it appeared to her to be a clever way to reassert our alter ego claims. We also challenge the impartiality of the trial court and seek reassignment of this case to another department upon remand. In August of 2007, defendant Raymond Shapiro defrauded my clients of their life savings of $400,000 when he talked them into rolling over an existing loan that had been set up by Mrs. Popowitz's late husband into another one of my projects, which he said would be one of his gas station mini-marts, as had been done in the past, but instead delivered to Ethel and Marilyn promissory notes from the Shell LLC that they had never heard of, called BA Sundown LLC. Shapiro told Marilyn that the loans would be like those previous loans with the deed of that had a deed of trust on them, but that was not. They considered Ray Shapiro a trusted family friend. As it turned out, the notes weren't worth the paper they were written on. It was Ray Shapiro who selected BA Sundown to be the promissor, one of his many LLCs that has about 30 that he runs. He selected that to be the borrower. There's nothing in the record that indicates that Bethel and Marilyn ever agreed to loan money to this company, BA Sundown. Now, counsel contends in their opening brief, their answering brief, that Ray Shapiro told Marilyn Popowitz about BA Sundown and their option. If you look at the footnote there, it's a reference to a declaration that was prepared by counsel, and it was signed by Mr. Shapiro. But we've cited his actual testimony, but he does not say that he explained this to these women. And besides, this is on a motion to dismiss, so all facts are to be viewed as true, as asserted by our clients, that are most favorable to them. And their testimony is that they never told anything about BA Sundown or this option that it allegedly had.
Counsel, discussion has taken place about the court's action on the motion to dismiss. But what troubles me is what the effect is given to the voluntary dismissal of, I believe at that time, it was the second amended complaint. Do we even get to this question about the motion to dismiss, given the fact that your client and you all elected to dismiss the complaint?
Well, let's make sure that our facts are correct on that. In counsel's answering brief, they make it appear that we were given one opportunity after another to amend our complaint to get our alter ego allegations correct, and that simply is not true. We, in fact, did amend our complaint three times, okay, but the Third Amendment complaint was filed before the motion to dismiss was ever filed. Third Amendment complaint was filed on September 18, 2009. The motion to dismiss was filed on October 2nd. And the hearing on the motion to dismiss was November 2, 2009. So there is no order granting us leave to amend, and there is no amended complaint after they filed the motion to dismiss. What happened, apparently, to address your question?
Well, what's the effect? What legal effect seems to me the starting point for analyzing this case is the legal effect of your voluntary dismissal. What legal effect do you give to it? You initiated it.
I was not involved in the case at the time, but I will address this.
Your Honor,
yes. Apparently what happened is the day after the motion to dismiss was heard and the judge granted the motion to dismiss, counsel and office who was handling the case thought we're still within the 21 days, so we'll go ahead and enter a voluntary dismissal of an alter ego claim to avoid sanctions because they had been threatening sanctions against us. And then we could gather some facts and reassert. And a voluntary dismissal is certainly without prejudice. I don't know about the wisdom of that. Personally, I would not have done that. But if that voluntary dismissal was effective, then it was without prejudice, and it could be reasserted again. But the trial court specifically ruled that that is not effective. It had no effect on her, and that she was ordering that this alter ego claim be dismissed with prejudice without leave to amend.
All right, but if the court treats the dismissal the same way you intended it, it was intended, whether it was by you or a person in your office,
right,
whose act you're bound by,
right.
I assume you agree
with
that.
Yes, certainly.
I mean, you do take advantage, that's an improper phrase, but you do seek to take benefit of the legal effect of that dismissal in its operation on the 21-day safe harbor provisions of NRCP 11. So, presumptively, we should give it effect across the board. And if we do, then the only error made by the district court, I would think you would argue, is treating the dismissal as one with prejudice as opposed to one without.
Yes, yes. And without having leave to amend at a subsequent time.
Right.
We would still have the same complaints about the impact of that.
I understand, but it affects the starting point for me, at least, is the case. So, should this court give effect to the dismissal, voluntary dismissal, or not?
Well, even if the court does give effect to the voluntary dismissal, we still have the order of the district court stating that it is, she's dismissing with prejudice.
I get that.
And that was ordered the day before our voluntary dismissal, the motion was granted. So she ruled that the voluntary dismissal had no effect. But even if this court views it as having effect, it's without prejudice, and we should have a right to reassert that. Now, one thing I want to...
I'm just trying to determine what appellant's view is here. Do you argue that we should give legal effect to the voluntary dismissal?
No, I do not. I do not. I don't think it was a wise move. I don't think it had any effect, and the district court ruled that it didn't have any effect.
So you're not contesting that portion of the district court's
ruling? No, I'm not contesting that, no.
All right.
I want to stress to the court that when our clients came to us a year and a half after they received these promissory notes when the payments stopped, that they knew absolutely nothing about BA Sundown. All they had was a promissory note that said BA Sundown promised to repay this money. They had no information whatsoever. We did, in fact, conduct an investigation and attempted to find out if BA Sundown was in business, had any assets. We couldn't find anything. And so we sent a letter to Mr. Shapiro and said, we view him as personally responsible for this. They sent a letter back, said, no, you can't sue Mr. Shapiro, we had a meeting, they gave us some corporate documents, a BA sendout, which just reconfirmed our opinion that it was Mr. Shapiro's alter ego, BA sendout. We sent them two follow-up letters and asked them to produce any other corporate documents they had. They didn't respond to those letters. So we proceeded with a complaint. And we alleged in the complaint that which we believe was in good faith, okay, that Shapiro and two of his companies controlled, influenced, and governed BA Sundown, that there was unity of interest, that BA Sundown was undercapitalized. Turns out it had zero capital.
Was BA Sundown, Mr. Marquis, LLC or corporate?
LLC, Your Honor. And that adherence to the corporate fiction would promote fraud and injustice, and indeed it would. Because Mr. Shapiro, it turns out, spent all that money that had been loaned by my clients on an option to purchase, and by the time the default occurred, BA Sundown had nothing left. The option to purchase was interesting, was entered into in 2006, we now know, and Mr. Shapiro personally guaranteed the $400,000 option price. Then he borrows the money from my client, puts it in BA Sundown, uses that money to pay that off, satisfy his personal guarantee, and then turns around to them and says, sorry, now you don't get repaid.
Can you talk about this in the context of the motion to dismiss at this point, based upon the pleadings that are now before the court when this motion comes? Because from the court's standpoint, whether or not some of the information you're talking about was actually before the court or not, we're looking at these pleadings, and that's what we're looking at.
Right.
And so, which gets us into the sufficiency of the pleadings, whether or not this is an appropriate dismissal under our existing NRCP 12b-5, or the alternative, if it's good under that, as well as the new heightened plausible standard.
Yes.
In the federal rules.
Yes.
So that's a concern.
And that's what I'm about to address now. I thank you for that. We believed that our allegations were sufficient. I mean, really, this is a Rocker case where the defendant has all the knowledge and information, and we alleged what we had. We didn't have any more. We had to get more information when we conducted discovery. But it appeared to us that the alter ego applied to have no corporate minutes. There was no capitalization that we could see in the financial statements. We only had the information that they chose to give us prior to filing suit. We asked for information, other information, they wouldn't give it to us. So that was all we had. And we believe that that is sufficient under a 12b-5 standard. If you look at the Crusoe case, where the plaintiff alleged that the defendant's city knew his stop sign had been knocked down and were negligent in not putting it up, they just alleged negligence.
What allegations in the Third Amendment complaint do you maintain, and excuse me, give me the numbers of them, do you maintain sufficiently stated an alter ego claim?
When you say the numbers on the paragraphs, Your Honor?
Yes, sir.
You can
supplement that.
Okay.
If you would. Thank you.
Okay, yes, we will certainly do that. We will precisely lay those out for exactly what our allegations were. We believe that those allegations were sufficient, certainly under the Crusoe case where they just said that the town was negligent. They didn't know how the town was negligent or what the underlying facts were. And this court upheld those allegations. In Walker, where fraud is supposed to be alleged with particularity, the court said, if all of the information is in the possession of the defendants, okay, then there's more leniency with regard to that requirement. And we think that means she should have been present here and that we should have been given an opportunity to conduct discovery, to acquire more information. And even under the heightened standard, I mean, under the 12b-5 standard, all those allegations that we made are to be accepted as true and viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs. And that to dismiss, it must appear to a certainty that the plaintiff is entitled to no relief. Well, I submit that in light of those allegations, the court cannot make that conclusion. If there is unity of interest, if Shapiro controls and influences this, if fraud and injustice would result by adhering to the corporate fiction, if this corporation was not sufficiently capitalized, then alter ego should apply. I think those are factual allegations. We didn't just say Shapiro is the alter ego of these companies. We didn't just say that. Maybe that would be a conclusory allegation, but we didn't say that.
So your point really is you made enough of an allegation that you should have been allowed discovery from the people who have the information that you needed and couldn't get anywhere else.
Absolutely, yes. Now, Iqbal Twombly was applied by the district court. This sort of came as a surprise to us. We didn't know that that was the law in the state of Nevada. And the court basically decided that our allegations were conclusions. We disagree with that, but then dismissed with prejudice without leave to amend. court asked us to address it both promptly. But I think if a new standard were to be developed, it should be a new rule, and notice should allow an opportunity to consider this. It shouldn't be sprung on a plaintiff such as Ethel Popowitz, you know, and have their case dismissed. I think that this is
should or should. I gather you're saying we shouldn't adopt the equal tomlay, but we're interested in comments from both counsel on. Should we take a look at that, or should we accept it or reject it or ignore it?
You know, notice pleading has served this state well for 60 years. There's a whole body of case law that pertains to notice pleading. And no one really knows the consequences of Iqbal Twombly. I would say that there's going to be a tremendous amount of confusion over whether allegations are factual or conclusions. And what's going to happen is that cases are going to have to be appealed at the initial stages because of this disagreement as to whether facts or conclusions have been pled.
But counsel, even assuming that we tested your pleading against the Iqbal Twombly plausible standard, could you say that your allegations are sustainable under a plausible standard?
Absolutely, they're sustainable under that standard. I mean, this court has repeatedly said that the elements of an alter ego claim are unity of interest, control, influence, and government, and would a sanction fraud or injustice to adhere to the corporate fiction. All of those are in there, plus undercapitalization, everything that we knew at the time. So even under that standard, we believe that we satisfied it. But in any event, whether 12b-5 or Iqbal Twombly, we should have been given an opportunity to conduct discovery that should not have been with prejudice. With prejudice wasn't even requested in the motion. It wasn't even briefed by the parties. It was slipped into the order by counsel and signed by the judge, and once it was signed, she would never change her mind after that. That was really unfair to my clients. In fact, when we conducted discovery, even though a lot of limitations were placed upon us, it turned out that there was an abundance of evidence there to support an alter ego claim. I mean, BA Sundown had no business, no assets, no anything else. The reason it was set up was so that it could acquire this option so that it could help out another of Mr. Shapiro's LLCs, IM Wolf, that owned a joint property that was trying to develop something called the R Resorts, and they wanted to use both parcels as part of this. So it was totally for the benefit of his other LLC and for him that he was trying to acquire this option. But he did that with other people's money. And it was going to take $15 million to buy this property, and Mr. Shapiro says he had no idea where he was going to get that money, even if the option was exercised. And in March of 2010, Mr. Shapiro terminated that option agreement and then turned right around and got a right of first refusal for his other LLC, IMF, to buy that very same property. So it was really heads out and tails you lose as far as my clients were concerned. They were never going to get that money.
You also alleged fraud, I assume, in the complaint?
In our amended complaint, we went back in after discovering this. I think that in the written document, the amended complaint, we didn't say have fraud in it, but during the oral argument, I made it clear to the court that we did intend to include fraud in our amended complaint. But before we got there, after we filed the motion to amend our complaint, we had a hearing before the court, before the hearing on a motion to amend, and the subject of my motion to amend came up. And we were told, in no uncertain terms, that if we tried to amend our complaint and reassert that alter ego claim, there would be more Rule 11 sanctions. This is a hearing on February 14, 2011. It's in the record at 1301. Counsel states that if we filed that and went forward with it, we would seek Rule 11 sanctions. The court stated, to me, you cannot have a good faith belief that you can move to amend. I just don't want you in a bad position again. And subsequently, 1307 said the alter ego claim is never going to be reinstated. So, the court hadn't even seen our motion to amend at that stage, hadn't even seen the facts that we had generated during discovery, but ruled that we could not even move to amend that and go forward. Prejudged that claim without even looking at the evidence. As it turned out, when we finally did have the hearing on the motion to amend, and reasserted breach of contract against Shapiro, alter ego against this other LLC, I Am Wolf, conspiracy, unjust enrichment, denied in total. So when Rule 15 requires that we be fully granted what justice so requires, and so all we were left with is our claim against BA Sundown that has zero.
Mr. McCree, let me ask you one thing. In reading this, we've got some interesting issues here, and I think probably while we're arguing it in bond, the cost of the alter ego, you're dealing with an LLC here. What about Nevada jurisprudence? My understanding, most alter egos dealing with corporations, they have this new form of entity, LLC, kind of like a derivative,
yes,
limited partnership or so. So you're saying we should apply the corporate jurisprudence and alter ego to the LLC issues?
Absolutely. I think all the rationale to apply Nevada to a corporation applies to LLCs.
And have you looked at the Rockway case, the recent, it's a post-judgment discovery in aid of execution where you're chasing recovery not against the judgment debtor per se, but against entities that may have assets of his?
No, I've not seen that.
Because, I mean, your client has, I mean, in essence, what you're saying is you should have been allowed to pursue this at least on discovery in order to realize a judgment that's recoverable against somebody meaningful.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And to address your question, Justice Gibbons, Judge Martelli, the bankruptcy case, you may be familiar with that, GM Pietro, it's 317BR841, concluded that all the reasons for applying to alter ego corporations exist with regard to LLCs, and it was his conclusion that if this court were presented with that, he thought in all probability this court would adopt that legal principle. And so I think, yes, absolutely. And otherwise, you just have a situation like this, where a person hides behind the corporate shield and defrauds people at will, and there's no remedy for the people that have been defrauded.
What about the sanctions against not only your client, the law firm, and all like that? Was there any basis under Rule 11 for the court to do that?
You know, first of all, the reason they did this is because we made the alter ego claims, and I don't see why making claims like that gives anyone a basis for Rule 11 sanctions. And nothing with Rule 11 was complied with. I mean, technically, we didn't get the 21-day notice. The hearing was on the 21st day, and so we didn't have that. The order does not specify the objectionable conduct or the basis as required by Rule 11. The order of November 22, 2010 says, this is page 715 of the record, it is hereby ordered the defendant's motion for sanctions granted, amount of $5,000 attorney's fees for his plaintiff and his counsel, Mark Dean Albach, and jointly severely liable. There's no finding of any inappropriate conduct at all, and I still don't know what we allegedly did wrong. More importantly, we investigated this. I mean, there's a two-prong analysis under Rule 11. Was the allegation there grounded in the fact? Was it a reasonable and competent inquiry conducted? And I think, yes, on both of those questions, we did investigate this. We did think that we had a basis for making these allegations on the limited information that we had been given by the defendant. And so for those reasons, we just think that the Rule 11 sanctions were totally inappropriate. I certainly don't see that Ethel Popovitz did wrong to warrant Rule 11 sanctions against her. And finally, on one other issue that I would like to address with the court, and that is reassignment of this case to another department upon remand due to the trial court's bias. Counties 1 and 2 state that a judge shall be impartial and shall avoid even the appearance of impropriety. Now, we do not see disqualification based on how the trial court judged this case. We see disqualification based on how the trial court prejudged this case. Examples of bias are the trial court prejudged our alter ego claim, threw it out with prejudice, never gave us an opportunity to come forward, doesn't interest what the facts were. Prejudged our motion to amend, precluded me from even coming forward with the motion to amend our alter ego claim, doesn't interest to know what the facts were. Signing over with prejudice, even though it was never requested and never briefed, and refused to change after that.
The alter ego claim, when the court was ruling on that, or the discussions on the record, us, and it seems to be a difference of opinion as to what the law indicated. Judge Leavitt seemed to say, I understand this area, these are the factors, you didn't actually put them in, therefore you lose. That's a short-handed version of what I saw reading the record.
I don't see how that complies with Rule 11. I don't see how that's misconduct under Rule 11.
Let's back up, though. As to the issue of the motion to dismiss.
Okay. As to the issue of the motion to dismiss.
If you're calling bias, so I'm having to look at this in total as to what this judge did. Was there any actual basis, non-prejudicial, in terms of...
The dismissal itself, I'm not claiming that was biased. That could be due to a legitimate disagreement as to the status of the law. And if she thought her allegations were insufficient, either under 12b-5 or Iqbal Twombly, that's certainly her right to rule that way. We should have been given an opportunity to amend at a later time. We should have been given an opportunity to conduct discovery. And that's what I see as bias against us here. And not the ruling itself, but going to that length. Now, I just want to say just a couple of other things about remand, and that is, you know, at trial, comments were made about our clients. The trial court said Marilyn Popovich was pretending and that her testimony was embarrassing, and stopped us in our cross-examination of Mr. Shapiro, claiming that he was guilty of perjury and things like that. So, protecting the other side, okay, accusing our side of not giving legitimate testimony, and it just comes down to the fact that our clients do not feel that they were treated fairly at any time in these proceedings below. And they do not think that if this case is reversed, that they will get a fair shake in the same department. And that we ask, therefore, that when this case is reversed and remanded, that it be reassigned to another department, and that it be expedited so 86-year-old Ethel Popovich has a chance to get her money back.
Also, that last reference you made in the district court, because part of the position that was taken was they were unsophisticated people they were picking up for the investments of, but it was put on the record that the party was a real estate agent, broker, something of that nature. So, in the badger.
No one got their license for a small period of time, it's true, Your Honor. But they are embarrassed about how easily they were defrauded of this money at this stage by taking these promissory notes and trusting him. Thank you.
We have 3 minutes and 17 seconds. Go ahead.
Chief Justice, Senator Justices, Pat Lindbaugh, along with Megan Sterich, and we're here on behalf of Almonds. There are 3 respondents that we are here on behalf of. Raymond J. Shapiro, who's an individual, Bayside Derivatives, which is a limited partnership, and Hayden Max LLC. I'm going to try to dovetail the 2 arguments as far as into one. But I'd like to start first with addressing the sanctions order that was imposed then by Judge Leavitt to begin with, because that's what the original order was. I'd like to reference the court to the decision in Edwards versus Empire Gardens. It's a 2006 decision from this court that upheld a district court when in fact Rule 11 sanctions were imposed against a litigant who refused to respect the court's order. The litigant in that case had asserted a position in an argument in opposition to a motion to dismiss. And they lost. And the order was entered. And thereafter, the litigant refused to respect that decision. They brought another motion. They advanced the same argument all over again that had already been soundly rejected. And in fact, they forced the parties and the court all involved to incur needless time, expense, and effort then to address then issues that had already been rejected. And the court said in that particular circumstance that the litigant knew and was on notice that the grounds that they were asserting were without reasonable foundation and therefore Rule 11 sanctions were imposed. And this court upheld the imposition of those Rule 11 sanctions, holding that in fact that an abuse of discretion had not been occasioned. In this particular case, you have a litigant that on 8 separate occasions refused to respect or to accept the district court's decision of dismissal on their motion to dismiss. On 8 separate occasions. And therefore, the conduct that is at issue in this case, in fact, is far worse than what was at issue in Edwards versus Empire Gardens. By the time that the district court had imposed the order imposing $5,000 in sanctions, they had argued their unsuccessful motion to dismiss 8 separate occasions. And one of the things I think that is important, kind of giving a little bit the back and forth in the questions with this court, also with the failure to adhere to what the factual record is, I think it's important for me to put a couple of these issues then in the context. They originally brought a complaint, and their alter ego complaint simply took the essential elements of an alter ego claim, and they alleged them on information and belief. In other words, they took the preface and they said, upon information and belief, Ray Shapiro controlled the Ray Sundown. Upon information and belief, Ray Shapiro governed the Ray Sundown. Upon information and belief, and they had other as far as entities upon which that they made the same assertion with no facts.
Wouldn't most of that confirmation be within your world, though? In order to make very specific allegations, all that information was available to the defendant and possibly no one else.
Your point is as far as in response to that, Your Honor. Number one, if in fact that that was as far as within our control, then the complaint never should have been brought in the first place. They should have been able to go through discovery then, and if, during the course of discovery, that they gathered the information as they contend and for which that we dispute, that they claim supported the claim for alter ego, they could have amended them at a later point in time. But to open the doors and to be able to say simply upon information and belief plus the essential element, then in fact, that is insufficient. Moreover, what you ignore is also is the pre-suit inquiry that they made. They did send a letter. And what this case essentially, why the alter ego claims were so hotly contested, is because they were asserted, in essence, as coercion. They knew at that point in time that the economy here in Las Vegas was very difficult, and that the Ray Sundown was suffering distress because of the downturn in that economy.
Ms. Lindgren, in all fairness, you give somebody money and you're supposed to move you back a certain amount, and then you basically say, we're going to do this, we're not giving anything back. They do have some right to be upset with your client in terms of not paying them back. But let's come back to the record. We're talking about initial pleading stage. We're not summary judgment, we're motion to dismiss. So in the context of a motion to dismiss, those basic elements that are put forth, was the district court correct under 12b-5 or in the alternative, because that's not totally clear whether it was dismissed under Twombly standards, Iqbal Twombly, or whether it was dismissed as a 12b-5. And maybe you can clarify that.
Now, from this perspective, number one, with the complaint, and I think it's important to understand how it is that we got to the motion to dismiss, because it is the motion to dismiss their third amended complaint. And so when we brought that motion to dismiss their third amended complaint, that motion was granted, and that's already a year into the case. And the court indicated that she was utilizing Nevada pleading standards in dismissing that claim. But the preface to that, and what serves as part of the foundation then, for the imposition of Rule 11,
I guess the question is, when you say she was using Nevada standards, she cited Nevada case and says, I'm aware of this case and these are the 3 points and you only gave me 2. Based upon pleading factors, one, this is a motion to dismiss. This is not summary judgment. And so the question is, did, under the standards, was there enough asserted, as has been argued, that this should have gotten by that?
No, there was not. And one of the things that I think that is important, kind of a little bit of a hint along that line, we put forth each one of the allegations on the alter ego claims in our answering brief. We cited the original allegations, we cited the First Amendment allegations, we cited the Second Amendment allegations, and the Third Amendment allegations. You don't see the specific allegations found within the open briefing cited by the Popovitzes. We're not running away from what those allegations were. All those allegations were upon information and belief, plus the essential element of the claim, which is a legal conclusion, and a legal conclusion only. They asserted no facts in support of their alter ego claim.
Mr. Lombardo, was there, if I want to call this up, in response to the First Amendment complaint and the second, you all filed a motion for a more definite statement at some point. Could you discuss that?
In response to the original complaint, we filed a motion for a more definite statement than of their alter ego claim. The response then to that was they filed a First Amendment complaint. And in their opposition, they told the district court that they had fixed them, the problems that we had identified them.
The court didn't go on the motion for a more definite statement, right? They simply responded with an amended complaint.
That's correct. They filed then their First Amendment complaint. In response then to the First Amendment complaint, what they had done was to add two additional parties. They added Bayside Derivatives and Henry Max. So what we did then, and there was no allegations, not even the essential elements of an alter ego claim against Henry Max and Bayside Derivatives. So we filed a motion to strike. What their response was to the motion to strike was to file a motion for leave to amend. And this is one of my primary complaints with the briefing and also with the oral presentation that has been presented to this court. They contend that they were never given an opportunity for leave to amend their complaint. They were. They filed a motion for leave to amend their complaint. Our argument in response to their motion for leave to amend, which would have then been their second amended complaint, was futility. In other words, if you grant this, it's going to be futile because they haven't properly asserted the claim. That's the same standard for a motion to dismiss. And the district judge granted their motion for leave to amend. She granted their motion for leave to amend and said, if in fact we're going to examine the sufficiency of the allegations, let's do it in the context then of the motion to dismiss. And they were allowed then the opportunity to file their second amended complaint. Thereafter, knowing as far as what the court's position was, they asked us to stick then to a third amended complaint. And we did, because we knew that the sufficiency of the allegations, that the district court preferred to look at it in the context of a motion to dismiss. And that's what we did. We filed our motion to dismiss, and it's now a year into the case. The court granted...
In a year period of time, was any discovery undertaken by appellants toward the alter ego claims?
At that point in time, no, Your Honor, there was no discovery that had been done. The pleadings had not been finalized, and so therefore, what was publicly available was out there.
But, I'm sorry, please go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you. But.
So, well, I guess to go back as far as to the information that was out there from the public standpoint, you can see the information that was with the Secretary of State. You could also see the information that was with the City of Henderson. Mr. Shapiro, on behalf of these entities, was seeking entitlements to these properties. He was also seeking, as far as roadway access, then to the Nevada Department of Transportation. All that information was out there, and it was a matter of public record, and they could see that.
So, but he never joined issue on the 16-1 conference and launched conventional discovery because it never got past the pleading stage, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And Ms. Long, that is my concern. Normally, when we get these cases, this is kind of unusual. We get this big discovery dispute here, motion to dismiss phase. It's usually in a Rule 56 motion with a 56F affidavit filed, and then we, the court, whether the court grants the 56F continuance or not. Here, I don't know what the appellants could have done here to compel your client to produce information and LLC records and operating agreements or whatever they'd be asking for before you have a 16.1, which wouldn't be triggered until an answer is filed on the case. And it seems to me that's the heart of the case. If there's no basis for an alter ego claim, you can move for summary judgment and say there isn't any basis for it, and in the meantime they have a chance to do their discovery. So what's your thoughts on that?
But now there's a proceeding, though, in the documents that we gave them long before they even filed their original complaint.
So did you give them everything they requested?
We gave them the articles of the organization. Mm-hmm. We gave them the operating agreement. We gave them the bank statements that said that BA Sundown had its own separate bank statements, that there was monies in and that there was monies out of those separate bank statements. We gave them compiled financial information. We gave them balance sheet. We gave them profit and loss statements. We gave them that information.
So you're saying there's nothing left on the 16.1 conference? Would there have been no more documents to exchange, you know, like from your client's standpoint?
Particularly from an organizational standpoint. Because an LLC, as our legislature has allows them, as far as we don't have to engage in the corporate formalities. Mm-hmm. You don't have to schedule a meeting. You don't have to do a notice of a meeting. You don't have to have written authorizations. Mm-hmm. That's what our legislature has allowed from an LLC perspective. And so that's the information then that we gave them. Okay. And no different than the Bergman versus Boyce case, where this court cited them. In fact, the counsel went forward in spite of their pre-suit inquiry, that the court would use that then as a foundation then, and to recognize then with Rule 11 sanctions then can be appropriate.
What do you make of the Iqbal Twombly progeny that says, in essence, that looks at it more forgivingly when the information is likely to be in the hands of the defendant? There are categories of information where one side is going to have much more access to the information needed than the other. And there are cases, I think one of them cited by your opponent under Iqbal Twombly, that say alter ego, that's in their world. So we're going to not test plausibility as toughly as we might in a negligence or a personal injury case. Could you comment on that and how that works in this context?
You know, if the district court had gone to the plausibility standard under Iqbal Twombly, I think that that is an apt inquiry. But in this particular case, she didn't. She only looked at what now is the first prong of Iqbal Twombly, and it is what I believe that this court has long required. And that is this, is that you have to allege facts within your complaint. You can't simply say upon information and belief and then tack on an essential element.
But by the Third Amendment complaint, maybe I'm wrong on this, I thought they dropped out much of the information and belief and were pleading factually, we thought we were doing business with Mr. Shapiro and it ended up we get this note from this entity and he won't pay us back and they don't have any money. I mean,
I don't mean to as far as to correct
No,
those.
Please do correct
it. In the Third Amendment complaint, the allegations of alter ego, the only difference that they made was they added two new parties. They were the same as the Second Amendment complaint, the First Amendment complaint, and the original complaint. And that's what was at issue in the motion to dismiss. If you take counsel's argument at face value on what it takes to plead a viable claim, what you could do is say, upon information and belief, the defendant owed no duty. Upon information and belief, the defendant breached its duty. Upon information and belief, that breach of that duty caused me harm. If you take their argument at face value, they contend that that's enough under Rule 8 to survive a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-5 their negligence claim.
If you take out the information and belief, though, it would be close to the form complaints in the back of the rules, correct?
At one point in time, that may have been acceptable. But as far as under the standards that this court has put in play, it still requires facts. And what I say this is this. When I go as far as I pick up my Nevada revised statutes, I open up Rule 8. Rule 8, the very first case that it cites to me, is a case called Hay versus Hay. It's a cohabitation case. It's dated 1984. In that decision, I quote, "A complaint must set forth sufficient facts to establish all the necessary elements of a claim." Hay versus Hay cited Johnson versus Travelers. That was a 1973 case. It says a class action case, and it was dealing with health insurance. Once again, I quote, "A complaint must allege facts sufficient to establish all necessary elements of a claim for relief." Western States versus Nikoff is another cohabitation case. It adopted the Hay standard. If we move all of this forward then a little bit of time, I look at then the Buzz Stew versus City of North Las Vegas case. It's a 2008 decision where this court said only factual allegations found within a complaint are going to be accepted as true, and the only place we're going to look for those factual allegations are within the body of the complaint itself. In 2011, this court then decided AmeriCorps. In AmeriCorps, the court said, citing Buzzsaw, and once again I quote, "To survive dismissal, a complaint must contain some set of facts which, if true, would entitle plaintiffs to relief."
And then so, looking at Buzzsaw, accepting factual allegations as true and then giving the necessary inference to other things pled. It's not as cut and dry as you're giving it to me. There's a little more leeway when you're looking at a motion to dismiss. That's part of the concern here.
Well, most of all, I'll see if I can articulate maybe a little bit of a simpler argument. And I'm hoping that this argument is, because it is so simple, doesn't make me look stupid. But when I look at Rule 8.1, 8A1 says this, "A pleading shall contain a short and plain statement of the claim showing that the pleader is entitled to relief." A claim that has to show the pleader is entitled to relief. That's what 8A1 stands for. 12B5 says that you dismiss a complaint for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. So the question becomes then, what is a claim showing that the pleader is entitled to relief? Is it simply legal conclusions?
That's where I have a question for you, and it's a very semantic issue. Why can't what you're classifying or categorizing as legal conclusions also be statements of fact?
If there had some specificity to the case, if there was something that had something to do as far as with the facts of the particular case.
But some of these, if you go through some of these statements, if you take out under information and belief, they can just as easily be factual statements.
Well, then as far as...
And legal conclusions.
Well, I guess the point I would like to make as far as in response to that is that the argument that's being made is at least being advanced, but in fact that the essential elements that have been adopted by this court sometimes can be construed as like a mixed fact or a mixed legal conclusion. So the issue becomes is how do you take those laws and then put those into the context such that they are specific to the case?
Some of these are very specific to the case, and understanding as well that a lot of the information that would be necessary is in their control solely. I guess that's where my struggle is, right?
Well, I guess as far as what I go back to is this, is what Judge Levitt was faced with was now a third amended complaint that had no factual assertions at all, or about information belief in the essential element that was established all the way back to the Stewart case, which is a very old case dealing with alter ego. And in that particular circumstance, one would have expected, though, for there to be some notice to the defendant what it is that they did wrong. And so that's what Judge Levitt did. She analyzed this case, you know, from the standpoint of what allegations, even if you assume that these essential elements contain mixed fact as well as mixed legal conclusion.
How do you respond to the issue that was brought up by Justice Stevens? We're not in the phone of discovery. We're not even into a 16-1 situation because of the human status. How do we then, for alter ego, or even theoretically a fraud situation, do enough to put into a complaint without allowing some kind of discovery or...
Justice respond,
but are we just stuck with this late 12B5 situation and boom, we go?
Justice Gillen, after the fact, the counsel has asserted fraud. In the original complaint, the First Amendment complaint, Second Amendment complaint, Third Amendment complaint, even the proposed Fourth Amendment complaint.
Deal with the alter ego.
In the alter ego claim, there was no factual assertions that were made against Bayside Derivatives or Henry Max LLC. They didn't even allege upon information and belief coupled with the essential element against those two entities. Not at all. They made no allegation whatsoever. And so therefore, the representative of those two entities, they look at the complaint. What notice do they have of what they did wrong that would subject them to the liability of BA Sundown's debts? And then the district court looked at the allegations against Raymond J. Shapiro, the individual. There were two that she gave them a credit for. And she was being generous in giving those credit, we submit. And that being this, is that Mr. Shapiro controlled BA Sundown. But isn't that what our legislature has allowed a member or a manager of an LLC to do? The second thing was, once again, that Mr. Shapiro influenced and governed BA Sundown. Once again, isn't that what our legislature has allowed a member or a manager to do of an LLC? And the third allegation, that in being generous, indicated that BA Sundown was undercapitalized to the extent that it could not meet its obligations. And under the Rowland versus Lapierre case, as cited then by the district court, that is insufficient to assert an alter ego claim. And so against the allegations that they repeated on four separate occasions, the district court said that, that was insufficient.
Now, Ms. Sundberg, I asked you two questions here, and I'm curious about number one. Is dismissal with prejudice justified by the court at this stage of the proceedings? Secondly, what's your position regarding Mr. Marquis' argument that we should adopt the jurisprudence of the bankruptcy court, Judge Markell, regarding analogizing LLCs to corporations as far as alter ego jurisprudence?
First, as to whether or not that the jurisprudence then should be applied the same as for an LLC as it is then for a corporation. The essential elements that this court has identified, we don't have any issue, and I also believe that in the Skull decision very recently issued by this court, that it was applied. And so we take no as far as objection as far as to that application. But as to the first question then, and that being this, and let me back up and just state this one last additional point, is that in a number of other decisions by this court analyzing and looking at whether or not an alter ego claim then has been not so much properly pled, but what are the factual circumstances that the court will take a look at in deciding an alter ego claim. There's a whole host of those commingling of assets, lack of corporate formalities. There's a laundry list. Not one of those on that laundry list of factual assertions that may support them in an alter ego claim have been asserted by the plaintiffs. Not one. Not one of those factual aspects that was set forth in this court's jurisprudence that's found its way into these pleadings or the amended pleadings. As to the first point, we ended up at the hearing on the third amended complaint. At that point in time, neither in the opposition or at the hearing did they make a request for dismissal with prejudice. Neither in the opposition or as far as at the hearing, did they make any request for the opportunity to do the discovery? They were entirely silent on that particular point. They allowed them, as far as the dismissal, which is now their fourth opportunity of pleading the complaint, they allowed the dismissal, and in the rule 31B, that is an adjudication on the merits. That is a dismissal with prejudice. And then in the context, when we go back into the Rule 11 issue, where Judge Levitt expressed on the record that she had major heart trouble, was the fact that the very evening that she issued her oral decision, they ran in and filed a notice of voluntary dismissal. And what they tried to do is to say, well, geez, our notice of voluntary dismissal trumps your oral order. At the next hearing, they argued that voluntary dismissal trumps your oral order because a written order hadn't been done, and that's why then it was without prejudice.
Your client had already made a general appearance by that stage, hadn't they?
Absolutely. Okay. You said that addressing sanctions at the very outset, there were eight instances where they flouted, in essence, that not your word, mine, Judge Levitt's ruling on the alter ego before sanctions were imposed. Could you list those eight quickly for me?
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me as far as put those in chronological order. They are in my notes. When we had the first hearing as far as on the sanctions, what they did is they went in and they argued as far as in their opposition papers as well as at the hearing, the same standards, the same arguments that they advanced. That was the first one. They did a motion to withdraw as counsel because that they had not been paid. In that motion and at the hearing, once again, they argued that the motion to dismiss was not proper and that in fact that they had properly asserted an alter ego claim. There was a subsequent hearing then on the amount of sanctions that should be supplied. They filed a supplemental opposition in opposition to the motion for sanctions. Even though the court had already ruled that sanctions would be imposed, the only issue that remained was the amount of sanctions. They then re-argued the whole foundation for the court's dismissal order again. There were a number of written discovery requests that were propounded to us. When we objected because of those claims had been, as far as denied by the court, they then filed motions to compel. In those motions,
that would have been post-sanctions, right?
No, this was all before the $5,000 sanction had then been imposed. All of this occurred then prior to the imposition as to the $5,000 order. Then they had two motions to compel, but once again to the discovery commissioner, they argued that in fact the dismissal order was improper. Long then after, in an opportunity, the motion for reconsideration on the dismissal order was permitted. They then filed a formal motion for reconsideration of that dismissal order. And so when you count up each and every time that the district court was required to revisit and that we as counsel were required to revisit the issue of the appropriateness of the dismissal order, it was a total of eight times. And that is a demonstration of the lack of respect for the district court for which they received a $5,000 sanction. And we asked the court not only to uphold the sanction, but also to look at and to examine then the pleadings that they put before the court and to realize then that Judge Levitt properly granted their motion for dismissal. One last comment if the court will indulge me. The court asked in its order for us to address the Rickball Conduct Standard. Our success as far as on this appeal is not dependent upon the court adopting that standard. But I do think that this court, district courts, and all litigants would benefit by the adoption of the Rickball Conduct Standard. Why? I believe that this court has already articulated that there needs to be facts, which is from the Tomlin case, and the Iqbal case talks about plausibility. Plausibility they use interchangeably with sufficiency. when the court, the U.S. Supreme Court then, talks about plausibility, they talk about sufficient facts so as to state a claim or to entitle a pleader to relief. And so they use those terms interchangeably. This court, in a number of decisions, have already stated that to be entitled to, or to have properly pled pursuant to Rule 8 a claim, you must have sufficient facts. And therefore, why it is that we contend that, in fact, both of these standards have already been addressed by the court. But I do submit that, in fact, the decisions have not always been consistent. And I applaud the court for all the work that has been done these last few years in trying to bring consistency to decisions. Because consistency clears up uncertainty. Uncertainty decreases the amount of litigation. And there's a whole host of reasons that we articulated in our briefs, and the amicus articulated in their briefs, why adoption of the autonomy standard then would be a good thing for the state of Nevada. And so therefore we would urge that as well. Thank you very much.
I do acknowledge that I went back in front of the trial court a number of times and tried to convince her that dismissing our claim with prejudice without leave to amend was incorrect, and that we should be given the opportunity to conduct discovery, and we should be given the opportunity to amend our complaint. But I thought I could convince her of that, but I wasn't able to do that. But that's not her basis for her Rule 11 ruling. There's nothing in her Rule 11 order that refers to these 8 occasions. I guess when the order doesn't specify any conduct, the counsel is free to argue that the basis is anything they want. But that was never articulated by the district court.
Mr. Murphy, what about this? Ms. Lundvall said that all these LLC documents, articles of organization, operating agreement, and anything they had was produced to you, and therefore the discovery was unnecessary.
Articles, organizational documents, a bank statement, a single financial statement, and an assignment of Mr. Shapiro's membership interest to these two companies, Bayside and Henry Max, where he signed as both Asinor and Assinee. That's all we had. We didn't have anything else. We didn't know how this money was spent. We didn't know about this option to purchase. We've never seen that. That was never provided for us, to us until discovery. We didn't know how Shapiro completely controlled and manipulated and ran all these different LLCs. We didn't know about Ivy Zerts and IM North and how he was doing all of this. So there was a whole host of information that we didn't have. We thought since we didn't have any minutes and we didn't have any other documents, that maybe the corporate formalities were not adhered to, and that we did have a basis for going forward. But that was just what they chose to give us, you know, and that shouldn't be what we're limited to, just that. I'm going to read from the Crusoe case, this court's Crusoe decision.
Before you do,
yes.
Ms. Lundvall said that at no point prior to the dismissal with prejudice order was discovery requested. And I may be overstating her point, but that's what I heard her say. Is that correct or not?
We did not yet have our 16.1 conference. We did not yet have an answer.
So the answer to my question is you didn't argue in opposition to the motion to dismiss that you shouldn't have such a draconian order imposed on you without benefit of discovery.
When I look back, I don't see that argument was made in the points of authorities. The Ninth Circuit did decide in the Cook decision 1990 that parties should be entitled to discovery, whether they make that request or not.
Okay.
Put that out, Your Honor.
But you do agree with her that you weren't making that sense of 56F type of...
That specific request, I do not see it in the record, okay. Your Honor. In the Crusoe case, this court said, a pleading may need only contain a short and plain statement of the claim showing that the pleader is entitled to relief, citing Rule 8A. In this regard, the pleading of conclusions, either law or fact, is sufficient, so long as the pleading gives fair notice of the nature and the basis of the claim. Certainly, our claim here gave fair notice to Mr. Shapiro and his two entities. And those specific allegations, Your Honor, are contained at page 38 of the record. And in addition, in that 30-minute complaint, we allege that at paragraph 67, under a different cause of action, that Shapiro, knowing the unsophisticated nature of Apple, provided her with basic unsecured notes, yet convinced her that the investments would be the same as done by Abe. But after invested money to VA Sunlight without a detailed explanation from Shapiro, that the investment was based upon his false representations, and that he can keep the control of her money through deceptions. Those are all contained within the complaint as well. So we will submit that, that we filed that complaint under the Crusoe case. We can in fact plead conclusions. Those should have been sufficient to survive a 12b-5. At the very least, we should have been able to conduct discovery and amend our complaint at a later date.
Thank you very much. I appreciate both counsel's presentation and the excellent briefing in this matter. It will stand submitted and will be in recess for the next call of the court.
Thank you.